It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to a guest who went on a mission to Mars. Well, not exactly. It was a mock mission to Mars. We'll learn about what was done to replicate conditions on the Red Planet.
But first, breaking news today. The American Civil Liberties Union of Wisconsin filed a federal lawsuit challenging the legality of the ban on same-sex marriages here in the Badger State.
The ACLU filed the suit on behalf of four same-sex couples in Wisconsin. Three of the couples want the state to allow them to get married. The fourth got married in Minnesota and wants Wisconsin to recognize their union.
Here to give us the details of this case is Chris Amity, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Wisconsin. Hi, Chris. Welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be here and talk to your NPR audience.
Well, tell us why you're filing this lawsuit.
We're filing this lawsuit because there are couples in Wisconsin, loving and committed couples, who are denied the dignity and respect that usually goes along with being married because of their sexual orientation or their gender. We think that's wrong, it's unfair, and it's unconstitutional. It not only denies them the dignity and respect that all loving, committed couples should have from their government, but also denies them hundreds of benefits that they would get if they were a heterosexual couple.
And on what legal grounds are you challenging the ban on same-sex marriage?
Well, we think that it violates some portions of the U.S. Constitution. It's contrary to due process. It also violates equal protection under the law. And, you know, but for their sexual orientation and the constitutional amendment that went into place here in Wisconsin and 2006, which prohibits all marriages, recognition of all marriages except between one man and one woman, they could live their lives and raise their families and go about their business with the same sort of support and dignity that other couples have. And I think that it's time to act now here in Wisconsin. You know, since the ACLU won its major victory at the U.S. Supreme Court this past June with the Windsor case that struck down a provision of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, we've seen an outpouring of support around the country for couples who really deserve to have their marriages recognized. There are now 17 states where there's the freedom to marry. And we've seen changes in polling numbers. A recent poll came out here in Wisconsin, and now a majority of Wisconsinites support marriage equality.
But let's talk about states' rights for a bit here. The amendment to ban same-sex unions, marriages, and civil unions has been ratified by the majority of Wisconsin voters. From a state's rights perspective, is that enough to maintain the law here in Wisconsin?
No. Just I can answer that because, you know, when it comes to constitutional rights, and the ACLU deals with this all the time, sometimes it's people who aren't in the majority that have their rights denied. And under our constitutional system, where there's equal protection under the law, if you can't come up with a compelling reason to limit somebody's freedom, in this case freedom to marry, you can't do it just because it's a tradition or because a majority of people voted that way or felt that way in an opinion poll. Of course, now the opinion polls have switched around. But I think that anybody who recognizes the fundamental nature of civil liberty, civil rights, recognizes that you've got to defend rights of people who maybe aren't the same as you. And this is a classic example. So, yes, you know, there was the referendum and the Constitution was amended in 2006, but that doesn't mean that that prohibits a review of the law, of the amendment under the federal Constitution. And we've seen that in many states around the country. If you look at the Windsor decision that ACLU won back in June that struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, you know, that decision really called into the question the validity of all these state constitutional amendments. It didn't overturn them, but really, since that time, there have been many challenges to these state constitutional amendments, and I think a lot of people are saying today, when they heard the news that ACLU sued, they're saying it's about time. We should have done this because the outpouring of support for couples has just been a tidal wave, and ACLU, we want to make sure that everybody has constitutional rights that are respected here in Wisconsin, in the states around us, Iowa, then Minnesota, and then recently Illinois. They now all have freedom to marry. Wisconsin really was in danger of becoming, you know, an island of prohibition against marriage equality, if you will. So it's certainly time to do it, and it's not something that's up to majoritarian rule. People have constitutional rights because they're important, whether you're in the majority or in a minority.
Why do you say that this is one of the most restrictive bans on same-sex marriage in the nation as compared to other states?
Right. Well, it's restrictive because it's one of 17 such bans around the country that bans not only marriage, but also anything substantially similar to marriage, such as civil unions, you know, a la sort of Vermont-style civil union. So they have that, but also in Wisconsin, there's another wrinkle that is somewhat unusual, and that's the fact that if a Wisconsin couple were to leave the state where it's to a state where it's legal to have a same-sex marriage, where there's already marriage equality, like Minnesota, like Iowa, we're going back many years, you know, Massachusetts. If they came back here, there's the possibility, it's a slight possibility, but there's a serious risk that they could be charged criminally under Wisconsin's marriage evasion statutes, very obscure sort of technical part of the statutes, but it's illegal to go to another state where for a marriage that would be void in Wisconsin. Now, we don't object to the marriage evasion statute when it comes to the uses that it's had in the past, you know, youngsters underage running off somewhere. But here, you know, while there may be some reason to restrict those or criminalize those sorts of marriages, there's certainly no reason to do that with same-sex couples. You know, there's absolutely no reason to do that.
Can you tell
that, other than that, you know, people don't like the idea, or it's not tradition, or whatever. But you know, if you're going to criminalize something, you just can't do it because you don't like the way somebody's acting.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the four couples that are represented by your lawsuit.
Sure. There are four couples that we think are really kind of typical of many, many committed, loving couples here in Wisconsin. Carol and Virginia are from Eau Claire. Siobhan and Marie are from Milwaukee, as are Judy and Katie. Roy and Garth are from Milwaukee, and all of them are in, you know, sort of traditional, they are traditional relationships because people care for one another. You know, 3 years ago, Garth had much of his right lung removed after being diagnosed with lung cancer. And he was put into a medically induced coma. Because Garth and Roy were not married, when Garth's father tried to override Roy's power of attorney to take care of Garth, there was all kinds of family problems. And sure, we want to respect parents and all that, just like you would respect your your in-laws, but if they had their relationship, their marriage recognized, if they were able to marry in Wisconsin, all those problems would have been sorted out and would have been known ahead of time and could have been dealt with. Now, Virginia and Carol, who are up in Eau Claire, you know, they went to Minnesota to marry, and they've been together for a long time and have had lots of the same kinds of issues that other couples have about, well, what about insurance and what about health care and visitation and all sorts of things. And because their out-of-state marriage wasn't recognized, it's very difficult, and they were really harmed in a couple different ways. One, you know, why do you have to go through all of this? It should be simple. You know, your loved one is ill. Why can't you just go to the hospital and be treated with the respect and dignity that you reserve when you deserve?
Well,
also,
Chris,
you know, it's having cost these and other folks, you know, in terms of hundreds and hundreds of different sorts of benefits that they would be eligible for in Wisconsin if Wisconsin would recognize their marriages.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
That's Chris Amedy, Executive Director of the ACLU of Wisconsin. He's talking to us about the suit challenging Wisconsin's ban on same-sex marriages. When people talk about the future of space exploration, the topic of a manned mission to Mars always seems to generate a lot of excitement and a lot of discussion about what life would be like on the red planet.
Earlier this month, a group of scientists headed into the middle of the Utah desert. For 2 weeks, they conducted a mock Mars mission to try and simulate what a real-life mission might be like.
Our next guest got to go along on the mission, and she chronicled her journey for space.com. Elizabeth Howell is a space journalist and was a member of Crew 133 at the Mars Desert Research Station. She's here to tell us about her experience. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Cynthia, thank you so much for having me on.
Well, tell us about the Mars Desert Research Station. How did you find yourself on the crew of a two-week simulated mission to Mars?
It was really an 11-year journey because it's been in existence since about 2002, and I've always wanted to go. However, you need to have some qualifications to get there, and in my case, I needed to sort of build up my experience in the space journalism field, which I've luckily got to do in the last couple of years. In addition to that, I'm also a student at the University of North Dakota, which is it's a space studies program. I'm a distance student, a Canadian who does the work there. And when I was doing my studies there, I still am, I got an email from one of the other students who happened to have been on two previous missions to the Mars Desert Research Station, and she wanted to know if anybody at the university was interested in participating. And that's essentially how I got on the crew. I presented my credentials as a journalist. They needed a crew journalist, and I got right on there. So it was pretty exciting.
When they do these mock missions, what's the goal? What are we trying to learn?
We're trying to figure out what kind of procedures and what kinds of experiments would work here and also on the red planet. Now, there are a few limitations, of course, where it's only 2 weeks as opposed to a couple of years, which is what a Mars mission would take. We can't simulate things like the lack of atmosphere or the lack of gravity or the lesser gravity that Mars has. But all that being said, there are a lot of things that are quite similar. We were sitting out in the middle of the desert, as you had mentioned earlier, and that meant that we had to basically rely on ourselves. The nearest town was about a 7 or 8 mile drive away over very hilly roads, and we, of course, were not encouraged to go there. We were in full simulation, and so we had to come up with a lot of resources by ourselves. Just sort of if something broke, we had to figure out how to fix it on station, that kind of thing. Another thing that we had to do as well was to communicate with the outside world only by email, because when you're doing a mission to Mars, it's about a 20-minute time delay between Earth and Mars, and so it takes some time to take communications there back and forth. And so email was the best way that we could simulate it, even though we didn't have a time delay. And then the third thing we did was we went outside in spacesuits, these mock spacesuits. That we would have a jumpsuit, we'd put on a helmet, we'd have a backpack, and we'd go outside every single time to do our tasks out there, because essentially if you walked outside on Mars without a spacesuit, you die. So we wanted to make sure that we had that aspect simulated as much as we could.
Why was it important to simulate it to that extent? I mean, you have perfectly good oxygen to breathe in Utah.
That's very true. But at the same time, when you're trying to do something such as set up a radio telescope, it's such a big difference if you're doing it in this mock spacesuit as opposed to doing it with just your normal clothing, as we discovered, because we actually were putting up a radio telescope, and those things are bulky and they're heavy, and you're trying to swing hammers and drive these stakes into the ground. Your center of gravity feels all weird because you got this heavy backpack on your back, and you're feeling all awkward. You can't hear things properly because you have the helmet over your ears. So it changes the experience completely, and what we thought was going to take about an hour to set up ended up taking two, just because we had all these different things to contend with.
We have a fashion picture of Elizabeth, by the way, in her suit on our Facebook page, Central Time on WPR. Elizabeth, how do you pack for a trip like this?
It's really hard because you're spending three weeks on the road without laundry. In the middle of nowhere, where you couldn't go out to get shampoo if you forgot it. So I was in terror that I would forget something important. And in fact, I did. I forgot lip balm. So I had to ask my crewmates to give me some extra, because it's dry out there. So what you're doing is you're trying to think, all right, what kind of things would I need if there was a power failure, where I would need extra clothing, I would need a sleeping bag, I would need to get various warm things. What would I need if my clothes got dirty? Well, I need extra clothes. And so you can imagine, you're starting to pile things on. You're saying, all right, I need warm winter clothes. I need cooler clothes. I need clothes for bedtime. I need clothes for working outside. And also, they have to be clothes that you don't care about very much, because anything that you put on got dirty within literally 10 minutes. I remember one time putting on some pants and looking down, already I had smudged mud all over them somehow, because mud would just blow in. We would keep the windows and the doors all closed as much as we could, but as soon as we went out for a Mars walk, so to speak, and came back in, we'd be tracking mud everywhere. We'd sweep it up, and then the next time somebody went out, the same problem would happen. So it was just a big challenge. I had four bags that I was carrying back and forth from Ottawa, Canada, all the way over to Las Vegas and zigzagging back to Utah because of flight paths and all that. And I just had to make sure I didn't forget anything as I was going along there. But it seemed to work out pretty well.
Tell us about the crew you were with.
They were phenomenal. They ranged in age from about 30 to 60 years old. They came from three countries. I was a Canadian. We had four from the United States and one from France, and all from different backgrounds. We had people that were a doctor on the crew. We had an engineer on the crew. We had a couple of scientists. We had people who had gone back to grad school after doing another career, essentially an executive career. So just having this diversity of backgrounds and opinions and experience really came in handy when it came to solving a problem, because it usually came to a situation where you'd say, well, we need to go back on some experience, whether it be managerial or technical, and somebody tended to have it. And that just made things amazing. So when it came to our discussions, we were very clear from the beginning. We were six strangers walking into this not knowing each other, and we said we have to communicate. We have to be as clear as possible about what we need, because if a dispute arises and we're all just walking around with these resentments bottled up inside, we're sitting in a 1,200-square-foot habitat, and we're just not going to have the capability to function as a crew if we're going to be all resentful and not talking to each other about situations. So we just came in with this idea that we're going to be a family, we're going to rely on each other. If we have problems, we're going to talk it out, and I have to say it worked out so well. In fact, I'm so close to everybody right now that I'm trying to figure out how to alter my summer vacation plans so I can see as many of them as possible. The guy from France, probably not so much, but the four in the States, definitely a possibility.
So what kind of things did you do on Mars? What were your operating missions there?
Our big mission, as I said earlier, was to put up the radio telescope, but we had a number of experiments going on. The doctor from France was actually looking at whether an untrained astronaut, could administer anesthesia properly to somebody who gets hurt on Mars. And that's important because, what if the doctor gets hurt? Who's going to take care of him or her? You'll have to be the other patients. And so he had a training protocol in place. He had a PowerPoint presentation and some videos and a mannequin, actually almost like an animatronic mannequin that would respond to certain things. And then he was having us inject simulated liquid into the mannequin and then monitoring the responses, which is really cool. We also had somebody else who was looking at helmet temperatures, as well as how much you were exerting yourself when you're going outside, to see if there's any kind of correlation between how hot it felt inside of there and how much you were running around out there. We had a survey that was looking at radio communications, what the dead zones were around the habitat, because for safety reasons, it's good to know where you're going to be out of radio communication. And then we had a couple of geological experiments looking at layers and also looking at hydrothermal vents in the area. So just being embedded on this crew and watching the science in action was quite an educational experience for science journalists, because you get to see how careful they are, how incremental they are, how much they rely on other studies to get their work done. And in fact, there already are some collaborations. They're a little early stage, so I won't say what's going on right now, but there, I already have seen at least one new collaboration coming out of this research, which is really exciting for them.
Elizabeth, very short on time here. Having done this, would you want to go to real Mars sometime?
Yes, but only if there's a return ticket.
All right, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, as always. I had fun.
That's Elizabeth Howell. She just returned from a two-week mock mission to Mars. She chronicled her experience on space.com and joined us to talk about what life could be like on the red planet. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Coming up later in the program, we'll get a special preview of the new Wisconsin Life TV show launching tonight at 8 on Wisconsin Public Television.
But first, from far-out space sounds to mimicking acoustic instruments, synthesizers give musicians an ability to produce almost limitless kinds of sounds.
Since their introduction in the early 20th century, these innovative instruments have been at the forefront of music technology. And our next guest has had the opportunity to play with nearly every kind of synthesizer created.
Joining us now is music educator, performer, and journalist Mark Vail. He's the author of the new book, The Synthesizer, a comprehensive guide to understanding, programming, playing, and recording the ultimate electronic musical instrument. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob. It's pleasure to be here.
When I think of a synthesizer, I think of something with a piano-like keyboard. But I, from reading your book, know it's more than just that. Can you give us a basic definition of what a synthesizer is?
It's an electronic instrument that is capable of making many different kinds of sounds and also processing sounds from other sources, whether they be acoustic or electronic or otherwise. And they became probably best known for having a keyboard because of certain popular models, but over the years there have been many different ways to learn to be able to play the instrument, developments in for those.
And looking through the pictures in your book, it could be anything from a keyboard, as I imagined, or a computer program, or the older ones, just a big, it looks like it could be a, you know, an airplane control room, the cockpit, just a bunch of dials and switches.
Yes, and some of them look like what old telephone operators used to plug callers together with.
Well, tell me about the first time you heard a synthesizer and why it got your attention and you made it such a big part of your career.
Actually, it may have been something I read first. When I was finishing up high school in 1973, there was a publication called The Last Whole Earth Catalog. And Wendy Carlos wrote an article in there about synthesizers, and it just really piqued my interest. And then I discovered bands like Emerson, Lake & Palmer and Yes, who depended a lot on synthesized sounds, and it went from there. So I've been interested in the subject since the early 70s.
Well, let's. You just mentioned Wendy Carlos. A lot of people might think pop and rock music, but she really pioneered the use of with a classical album, Switched on Bach. Let's give a listen. So that's Wendy Carlos playing on a Moog. Looks like Moog, pronounced Moog synthesizer. First, can you talk about Wendy Carlos's role in pioneering the use of this instrument?
Well, the technology that she was working with, she helped Bob Moog work on some of those devices. And they were analog circuitry that tended to drift depending on room temperature and static electricity and humidity. And to record that album and others, she had to be very conscious of the tone and also the pitch that came out of those instruments. So it was a lot of meticulous work that she recorded onto audio tape, magnetic audio tape. And many years later, she was able to resurrect those tapes and digitize them for CDs.
And I mentioned the Moog synthesizer, and you mentioned Bob Moog. He was a huge pioneer in on the technological side, wasn't he?
Yes. He started in 1963 and 64 in the New York area. Almost at the same time, Don Buchla began developing electronic instruments at the San Francisco Tape Music Center.
Let's turn to the Beatles now. Now, a lot of bands will have a pure-sounding, something you'd say, oh, that must be a synthesizer. Others have layered them in with organic instruments, and our producer, Carl, found a kind of a back-to-back contrast here. I want to listen to a little bit of the Beatles song, Here Comes the Sun, a brief snippet here.
Sun, sun, sun,
right, that's the original. Now, what somebody has done on YouTube is isolate some of the tracks from the Beatles song and done their own mix. So let's listen to that same bit and hear what comes out. Some strings there, real strings. What? And that's amazing, I think, in a lot of ways. It's hidden in there. It adds a texture mark, but it doesn't leap right out at you. Can you talk about the different ways people have integrated that synthesizer sound in with what we think of as traditional or organic instruments?
Well, that was a Moog modular synthesizer that the Beatles had, and Abbey Road Studios actually gave them their own separate room to keep that in. The sounds that Wendy Carlos and others used those analog synthesizers to create, they kind of approached the acoustic sounds, but that wasn't their entire purpose. Later developments allowed people to record strings into a sampler and then play them back and filter them like with a synthesizer. So there has been the gamut of trying to recreate acoustic sounds with electronic instruments, and also to create unique sounds that might be soothing or very very irritating. So there's a whole gamut that they've been used. And you hear a lot of synthesizers in music on the radio, on the internet, on television and movie soundtracks that you have no idea that that's actually created using synthesizers.
That was a big challenge, wasn't it? Wendy Carlos, I think you wrote, was frustrated early on because you could get a saxophone-like sound or a violin-like sound, but the idiosyncrasies of the instrument, the sound of the bow on the string or the unique reed growly sounds on a saxophone were really hard to capture, the attack and the sustain and things like that.
Yes, and I think more synthesis, I mean, they love to have control of the sound, but I think in electronic ways, is more desirable than trying to reproduce or recreate acoustic sounds, because most synthesis would never want to replace acoustic musicians, and in fact, many of us enjoy playing with acoustic instruments.
There's been a complaint I've heard from musicians I've worked with over the years and from music fans. There's, I guess, since the beginning of the synthesizer and pop music in particular, the sound that it's cold, it's unemotional, it's scientific, it doesn't have the heart of a guitar or a wind instrument. You are a synthesizer guy. How do you answer that?
I would say that they're limiting what they're listening to. They may have heard it here or there, but I bet I could find some things that they might change their mind.
Are there any musicians that you think have really used the synthesizer to a great end and really brought out a lot of heart with a synthesizer?
I have to go back to Keith Emerson with Emerson, Lake & Palmer. He had a big, huge Moog modular synthesizer, similar to what the Beatles had, but he was willing to take the thing out on the stage. He would fire off sounds with a ribbon controller that actually could shoot fireworks out of it. he just put on this show that many keyboardists and synthesists on stage are kind of forced to be in one place where guitar players can run all over the stage. And Keith Emerson was really the first guy who broke that mold and showed that you could actually do a whole lot of things and still make exciting music.
I went through a monstrous Emerson, Lake & Palmer phase as a kid. Here's one of their huge hits, and we're going to come into a big synth solo here. It's Lucky Man. Okay, my colleagues in the studio are making fun of me for nodding along and air synthesizering here. Tell us about Lucky Man and that solo.
Interesting story. When I was at Keyboard Magazine, in the late 80s or early 90s, when Emerson, Lake & Palmer were going to go back on tour, Keith Emerson contacted us because he was aware that Jim Aiken, an editor at Keyboard, had transcribed that solo. And Keith forgot how to play it, so he needed to be reminded. So I actually faxed the printout from the magazine to Keith so that he knew how to play that solo.
Wow. So it was a lost, well, not a lost chord, but a lost solo that Keyboard magazine helped him recreate.
Yeah, we helped him remember how he did it.
Did he remember the patch to use, the keyboard programmed patch?
Oh, I doubt it, because with the modular synthesizer, if you change anything, it can change the sound drastically. So I'm sure he came close, but it may not have been perfect.
We're talking with Mark Vail about his new book on synthesizers, how they came to be such a huge part of our modern musical landscape.
You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Are you a musician? What are some of your favorite synthesizer songs? Or maybe you think these instruments have ruined the way we experience music. You can tell us why you think so. Again, that number is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. From the experimentation of the Beatles to Cher's auto-tuned voice, synthesizers are everywhere in popular music, whether we are aware of it or not.
We're talking with author and synthesizer expert Mark Vail about the impact these instruments have had on modern music. You can join the discussion. Do you have a favorite musician, artist, band that uses synthesizers? Or least favorite? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org. We'll go right to the phones. We've got John with us in Neenah. John, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to react to your comment that some people sometimes make fun of synthesizers or have an aversion to it. And I'm of the opinion, and a lot of my musician friends, we think that synthesizers kind of got a bad name when sequencers came along, and a lot of bands or artists were coming out with synthesizers or computers just playing itself or playing the track, or you have tracks flown in on the stage and nobody knows where it's coming from. And I think people maybe appreciate more seeing people actually play the instrument, seeing a real live person up there playing the electronic instrument, but still actually playing and performing rather than having the computer play itself.
John, thanks a lot for the call. That's an interesting distinction, Mark. It's not so much the hatred of the synthesizer, but the sequenced drum, bass, and rhythm track behind somebody singing on stage.
And that's very true. It can be used like backing tracks, like some people accused of mouthing to a recording track. The sequencer I think John is referring to is like what you do on a computer. You play the musician plays parts into the computer, and then the computer plays the synthesizers back. Sequencers actually go back to almost during the early 60s, both Bob Moog and Don Buchla developed what were called step sequencers that would play the same ostinato over and over again. And they came back, modular synthesizers almost disappeared during the 80s because of digital synthesizers. But modular synthesizers began coming back in the 90s, and a lot of people are using those kind of analog step sequencers again, but they're very different than the songwriting tools that I think John is talking about that have been overused in live performances. So yeah, it is a fine line. People certainly would rather see real people playing things on the stage and not looking like they're checking their email on their computer.
Well, that reminds me of a band that really does it both ways, Nine Inch Nails, where Trent Reznor does a lot of, as I understand it, a lot of the albums by himself with sequencing, but then tours with the live band with, in addition to the synthesizers, real drums, bass, guitar.
I really appreciate that way of working. I like I said before, I appreciate working with acoustic musicians and electroacoustic musicians and mixing electronics and acoustics together. And I do get a little offended when people say, well, synthesizers aren't natural instruments. I have never seen a violin tree. The only natural instrument, you know, could be drums made from a tree or your voice. So they're all man-made.
Thanks a lot for the call, John. We'll go now to Joe in Madison. Joe, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I had a question for your guest on synthesizer build-it-your-own kits. I'm thinking about building one maybe out of an Arduino that I have. And I was curious if he has ever, your guest has ever built his own, and if so, if there was a particular design that he was partial to.
All right, Joe wants to make something with his Arduino do-it-yourself electronics kit. Is there a good, easy way to start?
Boy, that sounds like fun. I have put kits together. I have never designed one on my own. I have an Arduino, and it's something that one day I hope to work with. But there are a lot of people making their own synthesizers, DIY, either from existing kits or also from designing their own from scratch. I do have information in that in my book about that, because there's a wide community that that type of activity is going on internationally. It's kind of hard to give you a link over the radio, but they're in there. They're out there. If you do a search online, you can find all kinds of information about do-it-yourself synthesis.
All right. Good luck, Joe. And maybe you can call us up and play us a tune when you get that together. We'll go to Drew in Brooklyn now. Drew, hi.
Yes. Hello. A wonderful, interesting show. I remember in the 70s, Stevie Wonder's albums were thought to be produced largely by a synthesizer, and what your guests might have to say about that.
Thanks for the call, Drew. And wow, talk about a soulful musician embracing this instrument. Doesn't get much more soulful than Stevie Wonder.
Well, definitely. Stevie used for several of his albums something called Tonto, which was one of the largest modular synthesizers ever produced. So, yes, indeed, he did. He did use synthesizers, analog synthesizers. Later on, he met up with Ray Kurzweil, a futuristic visionary, and the two of them did a lot of work together to make electronic sounds, both more interesting to hear and to develop new ways of controlling them musically. So, yes, Stevie Wonder it has long been a user of synthesizers, and he's one of my favorite musicians, too.
I remember a Grammy thing with him, Herbie Hancock, Thomas Dolby, and Howard Jones demonstrating a castle of technology. My head almost exploded in nerdly joy. We'll go back to the phones now. We've got Donna with us in Fond du Lac. Hi, Donna.
Hi. I was calling just to talk about one of my favorite experiences with synthesizers as a teenager, and that was listening to Peter Frampton.
Oh, and the Frampton Comes Live, and he's got that, is that mouth thing that he used, a synthesizer, Mark? The "do you feel like we do" sound that he had on that? Sorry.
Actually, no, it isn't a synthesizer.
Right?
It's called a talk box, which has a little amplified speaker in it that's enclosed, and then there's a tube that comes out from where that speaker is, and Peter and other people who have used these type of instruments insert that tube in their mouth where they can change the cavity shape to filter the sound and say things like, "Do you feel like I do?" So, no, that actually isn't a synthesizer, but it's a very fun technique.
I want to play another clip of a synthesizer making the jump into rock pop, really grabbing the attention. It's Van Halen here. That's Van Halen Jump, which was, I don't know, number one for 90 weeks or something when I was a kid. Was that a big crossover? They were a rock, kind of a hardish rock pop band embracing the synthesizer, Mark.
Yeah, they did take some flack for that. That wonderful sound
that Van Halen made was with an Oberheim OBXA synthesizer, a polyphonic instrument. Tom Oberheim, who designed that, was also one of the pioneers who brought us to where we are today. And this kind of goes back to the sequencer thing. Tom designed a sequencer to play with his monophonic synthesizer, and by monophonic I mean it only plays one note at a time. So after he'd completed his sequencer, he realized he didn't have an instrument to play at the same time. So he developed another little synthesizer called the SEM, Synth Expander Module. And then he used that to create some of the earliest polyphonic synthesizers, instruments that could play more than one note at a time. And that eventually led to a complete instrument like the OBXA that was used in Jump.
Well, we've just really scratched the surface here of the history of the synthesizer and the bands that have used it. I want to look toward the future, though. We've seen auto-tune all over. People are doing auto-tuning speeches at home. Studios are using more and more different kinds of synthesized sounds. Processor speed is sped up. Where is this going? What does the future of music with synthesizers look like to you, Mark?
Well, I would say personal computers have for a couple of decades now been fast enough to actually do synthesis. And we've seen just a ton of development in laptop computers, also iOS devices like the iPhone and the iPad. And so there has been a lot of sophisticated development for those items. And at the same time, analog synthesis has become popular again. So I've talked to experts in the field who think that perhaps, well, when manufacturers create a new digital synthesizer, it takes them months and possibly even a year or longer to actually get it developed. And by the time it's ready to make, the microprocessors that are inside the unit have been replaced by faster ones. So the benefit of doing it with your computer is you can upgrade your computer as necessary, and then the software manufacturers keep those working.
Uh-huh.
So digital synthesis may go into the computer, and hardware instruments may, that's where analog synthesis, sounds that are generated with analog techniques, may stay strong in that realm.
We'll leave it there. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure, Rob.
That was Mark Vail. His new book is The Synthesizer, a comprehensive guide to understanding, programming, playing, and recording the ultimate electronic musical instrument.